Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations, where we talk about mental health, adversity, spirituality, and societal issues. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. Join me in this inspiring podcast episode as we delve into the captivating journey of Dina Kaplan, a trailblazing entrepreneur who dared to redefine success. In this candid conversation, we explore her bold decision to step away from her thriving startup and embark on a profound journey of self-discovery. Dina, known for her pioneering role in the tech industry, shares her story of her pivot, revealing the challenges and triumphs that led to her uncover her true purpose. With compelling insights, she takes us through the pivotal moments that inspired her to carve a new path and lay the foundation for the path, her transformative venture. Discover the raw emotions, invaluable lessons, and transformative experiences that shape Dina's personal and professional evolution. From the corridors or being a part of a tech startup to the serene corners of self-reflection, Dina's tale offers a wealth of wisdom for anyone seeking to reevaluate their own journey and find the courage to pursue their passions. Tune into this episode as we unravel the power of self-discovery, resilience, and reinvention with Dina, a visionary entrepreneur who turned her quest for authenticity into the creation of The Path, a platform that is redefining how we connect and engage with the world. Dina is the founder of The Path and a certified meditation teacher who since 2014 has been leading meditations and retreats around the world for individuals, corporations, festivals, conferences, and more. Dina writes about mindfulness for entrepreneurs in Forbes and has written about meditation for the New York Times, Time Magazine's Model Brand, The Standard Hotel Group, and Medium. Dina has studied and practiced dozens of meditation techniques, including Vipassana, mindfulness-based stress reduction, Vedic or mantra meditation, loving kindness or metta meditation, and more. Dina's mission is to give people the tools and inspiration to begin and continue a daily practice and to create community around meditation. Before The Path, Dina was an Emmy Award-winning journalist and founder of the digital media startup Blip. Please check out the show notes to get a hold of Dina, and please leave a 5-star review or comments in the comment section letting us know what you thought about the episode. Thank you. All right, Dina, welcome to the Easy Conversations podcast. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. I know it's fairly late for you, so super grateful for you to take the time and have this conversation with me today. But before we get started, I do want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to the listeners and let us know a little bit about what it is that you do, and then we'll jump right into it.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you so much. Thank you for doing what you do to share wellness and kindness and awareness to your whole community. Thank you to everyone for listening. I'm really excited to be here. I'm excited to chat with you and be in conversation and hopefully to be inspiring about how we can all live in a happier and more free way. And towards that end, my name is Dina Kaplan. I am the founder and CEO of The Path. And we do three main things. I am a certified meditation teacher, and I lead a beautiful meditation teacher training program that I actually taught last night, which I absolutely love. So it's a 3-month certificate meditation teacher training program. I also run a once a year curated meditation retreat that's called Mela. It's a really good time to talk about that because that is coming up. If you're interested in that, it's thepath.com/Mela apply, or for anything or any way that I can support you in meditation, you can also just email me at sit. Sit is another word for meditation, S-I-T, at thepath.com. And then we also have a wonderful meditation course that was my dream to create for about 8 years. It's called 30 Days to Meditator. It's at thepath.com/30 days. And the idea here is to teach people how to meditate in just 30 days for the rest of their lives without needing an app, so that if you want to meditate or feel more relaxation or calm or freedom or whatever might bring you to meditation, you don't need to turn on your phone to do that. You don't need to choose a teacher and a time and a length. You will have a whole variety of meditation techniques you can do on your own, however and wherever you want for the rest of your life. And then, of course, I do meditation for people and companies and festivals. And I love to go around the world and teach meditation and guide retreats. So you're noticing a theme here, a lot around meditation. And I also write about meditation for a bunch of different publications. So I kind of feel like my legacy right now is to share more calm relaxation and freedom and empowerment and choices for people all around the world.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. And just out of curiosity, why 30 days? And I'll put in a plug here. The reason why I ask is because I just released my book and it's focused on 30 days to self-love. But I want to understand why 30 days, and I can share why I thought of 30 days on my end.
Yeah, well, congratulations. That is awesome. And self-love is huge. So I'm really excited that you're doing that. The world needs that. And I can't wait to read your book. So we actually just had, I just had a very kind of powerful friend of mine who's always said, no, I'm not into meditation. Not for me, not for me, not for me. And then I told her about 30 days to meditate right after we finished the course. So it's kind of hot off the press. And she said, wait, it's not something I need to do for 8 years for the rest of my life. She said meditation always felt so intimidating. It's like another thing like flossing your teeth that you're going to have to do for the rest of your life. She said the idea of learning it in just 30 days and knowing it for the rest of her life, it made it really palatable. Like, this is something that I can do. And so I love that idea that in just 1 month, you can learn this new thing that can have such a positive impact on your mind and your body and your life. And learn it in just 1 month, it feels really easy and doable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's how I looked at it. I'm like, if people can practice something of self-love for themselves, whether it's journaling or thinking about self-love, how they can manifest it more into their daily life over the course of a month, it could become a habit. And that's how I kind of envisioned it. So we'll see how that works out. But your story, right? Like, I just wanted to touch on that. Why meditation now, coming and considering your past, like, if you don't mind sharing, what brought you to this state and in terms of all the work you're doing now?
Yeah, it's a pretty hardcore story. By the way, thank you for what you're sharing. And that's what I meant to say. So thank you for doing a better job than I did. The idea is to create a habit in 30 days, exactly as you said. So I come from a really unusual background for this. I came from a pretty business-oriented family. My dad is a professor at Harvard Business School. My sister is a doctor, but essentially running two medical practices. And I used to run a startup. So I founded it with four other partners and was helping to run a tech company for 7 years. But, you know, I figured out my job, but what I couldn't figure out was how to be myself in that role. I was running a tech company at a time that there were very, very, very few, i.e. only two of us that I knew of at the time, women founders in the whole country. And I had no role models. I didn't know where to turn for how I should act in this role. I just thought, okay, I need to act like a guy because all the successful founders that I knew of, from Mark Zuckerberg to Peter Thiel to Jeff Bezos, on and on, they were all men. So I thought, okay, for me to survive in this tech world that's so male dominated, I need to subjugate all of my natural instincts. So mine were, if something went wrong, I'd want to cry. Emotional in some way, I guess traditional. Sometimes we go back into our traditional gender roles. And so I might cry at my startup, and my co-founders did not know what to do about this. They're like, what is going on, Dina? There's no crying at startups. It's like baseball. So over time, I just learned to suppress all of my natural instincts. And I can be funny, or at least try to be, and fun and weird and quirky and, you know, just very me. But I wasn't sure that that would fit in at a startup. Would that fit in into this male-dominated kind of bro environment? So I suppressed my natural personality. And what's interesting is what happened is that my body revolted on me and I started having panic attacks. I didn't know what they were or why this was happening, but they started happening constantly. And I don't know if you or anyone in your community can relate to this. I feel like I was about to faint. Like, I would feel tingles at the top of my head. They would shoot down through my whole body. And it was so bad that for me, having these constantly for 2 years while running the company, I was afraid to cross the street by myself because I didn't know if I'd make it to the other side. I was way too afraid to take the subway because I had panic attacks in the subway and would be holding onto the wall, like praying that something awful wasn't about to happen to me. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like I stopped living as a really free moving human. It was a really scary existence. And yet I completely masked this. Nobody knew. I looked great from the outside. I would still do my hair every day and do my makeup and put on nice clothes and pretend that everything was okay, when in fact I was an absolute disaster on the inside. Mm-hmm. One day when I was across the street from my office, I wasn't even sure I could cross the street, a 13-second walk in Soho in Lower Manhattan. We were based out of New York, the startup. I wasn't even sure I could make it to the other side. It was like this voice of intuition came through me, and it said, you've got to get out of here. You need to lead the opposite life in the opposite part of the world, and you need to act right away. And so I had raised $1 gazillion for this company. I was the face of the company. I was super involved in the operations of the company, and I gave everything away. I gave it all away in a moment. And ended up, I did a transition with the board, but I ended up booking a one-way flight to Asia. And with a smile and a wink and a nod to the cliche, I flew to Bali. I'd never been. I kept teasing my coworkers, when we sell the company, I'm going to move to Bali. And they said, maybe you should try going there for a couple of days first. So I booked a one-way ticket to Bali. And I ended up traveling around the world for 2.5 years. In the end, in a journey to get healthy and to learn, really relearn to have the confidence to be myself.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing all that. And I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. So, I mean, I can relate when we don't listen to our inner voice, or we're not finding a way to express our true emotions, they do come out in different ways. And often that's presented as a disease or illness or chronic pain, because it is that stress building up on the inside. And that's amazing that you had that inner voice that told you what to do. And we all have it from time to time, and we seldom listen to that voice, because obviously it requires a lot of courage, and sometimes it's giving up a lot of things that we've created in our life that makes us feel comfortable. In your case, walking away from this company and walking away from the money, that takes a lot of courage, but it was something that you believed in. And how was that process? Like, was there any reluctance, or was there any hesitation on your end where you're like, you had to think through all of it, or you just kind of went with it?
Yeah. I mean, the money was one thing. I used to walk around New York and look at not just apartments, but buildings, and think, oh, one day I'll buy that whole townhouse. Not the bottom floor, the top floor. I'll buy that whole one, and maybe the one next to it. I had absolutely no doubt that I was going to make my $5 to $15 or $20 million, zero doubt. And yet I walked away from all of that. I ended up, I don't know if I've shared this publicly, I'll write it in the book. I did not make a dollar off of Blip. I thought I for sure would make at least, let's say, $10 million. I didn't make a dollar. But honestly, that was the least of it. What I walked away from was being in the press every single day, was giving talks at conferences every single, literally 7 nights a week. I would be speaking at some conference, some dinner, something. It was this whole kind of glamorous looking life from the outside, and it completely masked 100% dysfunction on the inside. And I appreciate your asking. No one's actually ever asked me that. What was it? I'll tell you. In one day, I lost half of my friends. Funny, my assistant at the time, who really did not like me at all, the one thing she would say to me was, Dina, you have a lot of people riding your coattails. Or she was essentially saying, half the people around you are just using you. And it turned out, I didn't understand what she was saying. I'm a little naive. I'm in the end kind of like a nice girl from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from the mid-Atlantic. So I lost half my friends, half the people that I was talking to and going to parties with, and I was helping them with VC connections and getting into this event and that event. I literally never spoke to me again. And you know what? That was friggin' awesome. And I realized that when I started traveling, when you're traveling, there's kind of a circuit of world travelers. Nobody cares what your job is. Nobody cares what venture capitalists you know. No one cares if you know the tech reporters at the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. They just want to know, are you cool to hang out with? Are you fun? Yeah. Are you up for adventure? Are you nice? Are you a good listener? Are you kind of cool to hang with the group of friends that are traveling in wherever you are, Luang Prabang or wherever you are?
Yeah.
And it was so liberating. It's funny, I've never talked about this before. It was so liberating to have people just like me for me, not for what I could do for them. Not, I've always had, and we can maybe talk about this, in a little bit, because probably relevant to my own story. I've always had this really big insecurity. It might be why my first job was at the White House. My second job was at MTV News. My third job was as a TV reporter. Even if I wasn't good enough to talk to at a cocktail party, whatever job I had, I could kind of hang my hat on that and know that I was interesting enough because I could share stories from MTV at the time. That was cool a long time ago. So now for the first time, really for the first time in my whole adult life, I just had to be me. I just had to be Dina, and I had to be someone that was cool to take a walk with at a night market in Asia. And so that ended up feeling scary and absolutely awesome, totally liberating.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think there's something to be said around expectations that we place on ourselves, but often are subconsciously coming from our family too, right? Or our parents. I know I took a lot of it from my parents, but you know, as you mentioned earlier, your dad's a professor at Harvard and your sister's a doctor with two practices. So like, you know, when you're surrounded by that, you almost want to also step up or do things to kind of fit in, right? And then we put that pressure on ourselves, and it doesn't matter what we end up doing. I think that's what we end up realizing later, right? And to your point, that's something you've realized in your adult life, that perhaps it's not about what you do, it's about how you feel regarding what you do, and that's important. So I don't know if that kind of resonates or if that's something that aligns for you.
Yeah, it's funny. So my dad is a professor at Harvard Business School and would always say the greatest thing that you can do as a person in the working world is to create a company and give good jobs to people and pay taxes into whatever country you're paying taxes into and be part of the functioning economy, world economy. So I thought, okay, I need to be an entrepreneur. The truth of the matter is I'm not really so well suited to being an entrepreneur. A lot of that is management and you're in meetings and you're running finance and doing your books every month and all of that. So it's funny, I'm probably a better writer. And my parents said to me about 10 years ago, you know, we always thought you'd be a writer. Like, oh God, you're absolutely killing me right now. So yeah, we're just meant to be ourselves. It's funny, I wrote an email to the Path community today to promote my friend Ozan Verol's book, and he's writing a book that actually came out today called Awaken Your Genius, like how to do a better job just being yourself. And I feel like we could all take lessons in that. How can we take a lesson in having the confidence to be yourself?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I guess as part of your journey then, you know, going to Bali and then traveling the world for 2.5 years, one of the things I've learned through travel is it gives you different perspective. And to your point, you also met other people, you get to learn about people's stories. But I think just exploring makes you realize there's so much more to life than just being cooped up in an office or trying to make money or raise money for that matter. What was your experience? Like, what were some of the main realizations you had as you were exploring the world?
Thank you. By the way, you're the best listener ever. 2000 props to you for that. So as I began traveling, I had some really profound things happen. And I'll echo back what you're saying. My friend Gary Rabkin wrote to me one day and I said, I'm learning so much about myself. I'm learning about the world, but I'm learning even more about myself. And he said, you take a fish out of the water, you learn a lot about the fish. I mean, you can't, it would be very hard to program a person. I know people are trying right now, but you don't know how you're going to respond in all these different situations until you're in them. And you're in so many different situations, kind of every hour, every minute when you're traveling, that it's a wonderful way to learn about yourself. So I had a moment when I was in northern Thailand in this beautiful hilltop town of Pai, and I met a fellow traveler, and he said, use this time that you have, Dina, that's like a gift, to conquer your fear. And what he said, it just went right over my head. Oh my gosh, as I talk about this, whew. You know, we're getting real here, so let's get real. So I kept thinking about what he was saying, but it didn't make a lot of sense to me. And then 1 month later, so I actually went to Cambodia, I saw Angkor Wat, I went to the killing fields, very deep time, very thought-provoking in Cambodia. And then I came back to Thailand and I was on, for the first time, the beautiful Thai island, so the first time in a long time. Mm-hmm. And I was walking down a path in this beautiful island of Koh Tao on the eastern side of Thailand. And all of a sudden, this fellow traveler's words from a month ago came through me. Use this time that you have like a gift to conquer your fear. And I realized, oh my gosh, I'm living with so much fear. I just didn't label it as fear. I'm even afraid to walk down a street by myself. I'm having panic attacks constantly. And I decided to take a huge gamble. I decided that I wanted to start conquering all of my physical fears and hope that I could overcome my biggest fear of all, which was having the confidence to just be myself, to ask for help, to say what was on my mind, to try to be funny, to be quirky, to really be me. And it was amazing that this realization took place in Koh Tao because it's the scuba capital of Asia. And my biggest fear was scuba diving because somebody had died on the first scuba diving trip I'd ever taken as a kid with my family. And at that moment, I had just thought, okay, clearly I'm not meant to scuba dive. If someone died on my first ever scuba trip, what are the chances of that? But I realized in that moment that if I wanted to really conquer fear, I needed to start with a huge one. So I went up to what I'd heard was the best scuba shop at Koh Tao called Scuba Junction. And I said, hey, someone died on my first ever scuba diving trip. And I'm having panic attacks constantly above ground, but I'd like to learn to dive. And they said, can you pay? And I said, yeah, I can pay for a discovery dive. And they said, okay, come back tomorrow. So I went back the next day. I prayed no one else would show up. No one else showed up. I had this very good looking instructor who looked like James Bond. And it was just the two of us. And I said, can I hold your hand when we go under the water? I'm terrified. And he said, I've never done that before, but sure. So I did that. And we went under the water and I did my first dive. And it was, I mean, first dive since being a teenager and that scary incident with my family. And I did it. And I came away feeling like a different person. I felt so confident. And I knew from that moment onwards that my life was going to change and that I could do things, shift patterns, and do things I never thought I could do in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a pretty cool story. And for that other fellow traveler to see something in you and be able to point it out, right? We often have those moments. I can think of a couple where someone's just seen me in a way that's really profound and pointed something out. So yeah, that's amazing. So then after all those experiences, I'm sure there were probably more where you had to face your fears. What made you want to go down this path of being a meditation teacher and doing all the work you're doing today?
So it came in the form, my Pied Pipers, my gurus always seem to come in the form of these good looking gentlemen. I don't know what's going on with that. But another one was walking off a plane with me, right behind me when I just landed in India for the first time. And it was actually all these Northern European guys. There's another Northern European traveler who I'd never met before. And as I'm walking off the plane, he said, what's your plan for India? And I said, I don't know. I'm actually pretty afraid to be here by myself. And he said, well, I'm going on a retreat. Do you want to come with me? So I actually thought he was asking me on a date. I said, yes. Turns out he was taking me to a 12-day gender segregated, silent Vipassana meditation retreat, which is like the worst date of all time. But there I was, having followed this cute guy and gender segregated now. And what he hadn't mentioned is that there would be no soap and no toilet paper and that it would be 120 degrees about Fahrenheit, about 40 degrees Celsius. So hot, I literally thought I was going to die. And show up. And that was how I learned to meditate. There was no way out. There were no tut-tuts, no buses, no Ubers, no nothing. I had to stay. And on this retreat, we were meditating 10 hours a day. They took your phone, your computer, everything, even business cards, everything was taken away from you. And you're really just meditating 10 hours a day and sleeping and washing clothes and eating, nothing else. You weren't even allowed to walk or do yoga. But I really learned how to meditate on this retreat. And on day 8 of the retreat, so about 86 or 7 hours into meditation, I had this huge insight. And I realized that I had been optimizing my entire life to be popular after having been bullied as a little kid at summer camp, something I'd never thought about before. And at the minute I had this realization, it was like a flash of lightning flashed up through me and exploded over my head. And this voice, again, like at that intersection, came to me and it said, you're going to come out of this retreat a better person. And everyone should have the chance to do this. A better person, meaning I would finally gain the confidence to be myself and not be so pleasing. So that voice said, everyone should have the chance to do this, but it doesn't need to be this hard. When you're ready to go back to the United States, you will start a company. You will be part of the movement that pushes meditation to the mainstream. You'll make it fun and delightful and beautiful and, dare I say, sexy to meditate. And you'll call the company The Path. And I open my eyes, I'm surrounded by 199 people from India and just a handful of other Westerners, and everyone is in silence. So I had to keep this to myself, but I was given my mission in that moment. And that's the mission that I'm living and following up on even right now, 11 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's powerful. And to have that realization just in that moment, just being there randomly, right? Not planning to be there. That's pretty crazy. And so coming back then, obviously, to the United States, what were some of the challenges you encountered, right? Because now you're starting something from scratch. It's probably not really 11 years ago. Meditation was still kind of early stages in the West. And, you know, you're coming with a completely different background now. So what were those challenges like early on to live this dream of starting something new?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I mean, it was a dream and a nightmare because when I was helping to run Blip, my first startup, the tech startup, I thought the one thing I'll never do again is run a company, never. And then when that intuition came to me, I thought, oh my gosh, you've got to be kidding me. So it was a dream and a nightmare. It is a great way to scale something. I do think if the Buddha existed today, he'd either give a big TED talk and talk about meditation that way, or he'd probably be running a startup and scaling his teachings through online courses. That's what I believe. So I knew it was a great way to scale what I had learned. But thank you for asking about the challenges. There were massive challenges. The first one was working again, because I had gone from working absolutely nonstop, nights, weekends, the whole thing at Blip, to not working for 2.5 years. I learned how to hula hoop. I actually can still, I think, get a hula hoop over me. I learned how to do the fire dancing, the poi. I got really, really good at Italian. Like, I was just used to learning things, living this playful existence, making friends in a little island off of Sicily, and then having, you know, experiences with them, and then going to Fiji and meeting another set of friends. So I was living this kind of dream existence. Now, all of a sudden, I am friggin' in it. I have people that are working for me. I didn't really raise money. I raised a tiny bit of money, but I didn't raise enough to pay people. So now I need to generate revenue to pay the people working for me, run a website, get people to go to this weird thing called meditation that was not a big thing at the time, everything they're saying. And then I had a really, I guess, I've been talking about this before, I had essentially an abusive co-founder at the time, a really mean, very difficult co-founder. And I just wanted to be nice. At that time, I thought being Buddhist, being a meditator meant just being nice. Now I know it does not mean being a doormat. Monks have to sue other monks and other people if there's trespassing or issues with the monastery. So you can be fierce in a Buddhist. You can quote me on that. But at the time, I was a little insecure about my own path in that spiritual world. So I thought, oh, I just need to be nice, even to someone that's really not nice to me. So I was suffering. It was really hard. But I was used to working it. I've always been good with the press. So I charmed a New York Times reporter, and she ended up putting us on the front page of the New York Times style section. They filmed that our second month in existence. So now we're in press all over the world. The London Sunday Times picked that up, and In Style and Teen Vogue and on and on and on. We're in every press outlet that I could ever imagine. And my life is just becoming really intense, right? Once again, all the interviews, all of the operations of the company. And I was not so mindful then. I lost a friend who's now very famous. And I regret that even if she had not become famous, I would still regret it, because I just wasn't in that. Oh, it was too hard of a transition to go from meditating, swimming in the ocean 3 hours a day, Dina, to being a founder, CEO, and running a startup again.
Yeah. Yeah. So did it feel like for you in that moment or at that time that you'd basically come back to the same lifestyle, even though you were trying to start something completely different. And, you know, it was based on meditation, but it sounds like you were kind of back in that high pace life again.
I definitely was. So there I am. I'm publishing articles. I am speaking at events. I'm on podcasts. I'm doing the press. I'm doing the operations. I'm living this, ironically, kind of fast-paced lifestyle. It just happens to be centered around the field of meditation rather than in the tech world. So it was a lot. And I am, if I look back on that girl, sorry, call myself a girl, I did let go that co-founder, and I'm so glad that I did that. That was a huge stand for kindness. And I shifted some things around about the company, and just every day I had that fear, journey that I'd been on was real. I went from the scuba diving to moving into a place in Laos you can only access by zip line, because I'm terrified of zip lining, and then doing this terrifying bungee jump off a bridge in New Zealand. I had conquered every physical fear. And so I was at the point where I was ready to practice being myself. And so that meant being vulnerable. That meant being quirky at work. And that meant each day, or at least each week, or at least each month, practicing being myself now as a leader. And honestly, it's something I'm still practicing, but I'm pretty vulnerable. I'm vulnerable with my team. If I don't feel well, I'll say so. If I need help with something, I'll say so. But for me, that's definitely a journey.
Right, right. So it sounds like, you know, earlier on when you were doing that startup work and suppressing your emotions, now it's important for you to be vulnerable and be open about what you're experiencing and asking for help, which is something you said you promised yourself. So yeah. So, I mean, obviously, it's all a work in progress, and we're all figuring it out. Right. And then you said the importance of being yourself is so crucial for you. And we kind of hear that quite a bit in the media and everywhere, be yourself. And I mean, I kind of have an idea what that means, but what does it mean for you to be yourself? And how is it different than what is so cliche in the media of us being told to be ourselves?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'll say that I don't want to say I struggle with it, but I'm very mindful of it, because I've also taken the Buddhist vows. So yes, be yourself, but also do no harm. So do no harm with your language, but also do no harm with your actions. Actually relates to a point of vulnerability. Not to get too vulnerable, but we are going there already. A point of vulnerability that I have is that I'm so careful to not do any harm with my voice, which is part of the Buddhist vows, that if I'm very angry at someone or hurt, let's say in a professional context, I won't say anything. I won't say anything. So now I've done no harm, but they can probably feel and know that I'm mad and I'm angry. And I think part of my own practice will be to express myself that felt badly when I felt hurt, when to express myself and have enough confidence to do that and not worry so much how the other person will take it, rather than just not saying anything, because I will have a tendency to just clam up if I am upset. So at least I'm not raging. I'm not mean, but almost to a fault. So for me, I know myself. I will tell a ton of jokes, and about half of them will be funny. So if I'm myself, what does that mean? That means I'm like, not to date myself, but I'm kind of like a Naked Gun movie, right? I was like, keep trying to be funny. I'll say things that are a little weird, quirky. I will need time off. I love to take at least 24 hours off every week. I don't always do it. I seek to do it. And I mean a full 24 hours off everything. Phone, yeah. Computer, all digital. So I'll say if I need that. I'll know, like today, I knew that I wasn't feeling well. We're about to produce Mela, so I've got a million gazillion things going on in terms of production and marketing and all of that. And I could feel in my body as a Vohashana meditator, I could feel, ooh, I feel stressed. So rather than working inside, what is being myself? That meant I can go outside. Maybe that's not a big move, but the old me would not have done that. The Blip TV startup Dina would not have done that. But I went outside. I'm in Savannah right now this week. So I went to a beautiful field outside, Forsyth Park, and kept my phone. So I was able to get some work done, but I looked looked at the trees. I was able to kind of do some fun things. I went to a chocolate shop. So it means taking care of myself, not just powering through, sort of following my own intuition as to what's healthy for me and what's not.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I definitely agree with you. I mean, to be able to express ourselves, I think that often we get told, or the messaging we receive, is even being angry is a negative emotion. But I think being angry is fine. It's how you communicate it, right? And there's being assertive, not raging on other people, but expressing yourself. And I think that's the idea of being yourself. That's at least what I've integrated into my life, is speaking my truth, whatever that may be. And if I feel a certain way, if that's going to offend someone, that's not on me. It's how I feel, right? And I'm still mindful of doing no harm, but it's still important for me to speak my truth and how I feel about certain things. So that's how I look at it. But yeah, so I mean, you've touched on Mela a couple of times. I know, unfortunately, we won't be able to release this episode before the event, which is coming out, which is in May. But for people that would be interested, perhaps for next year, or would like to learn more, yeah, if you don't mind sharing what this event's all about.
Yeah, I would love to. I will add to what you said. I wrote an article called Why I'm Over Authenticity. Don't hate me. I do think being authentic is important, but I think it's the first step. And I think the second step is to pair that with an awareness of how what you're going to say will land to someone else. Right. So we want to be authentic, so it's an overused word, as you say, but also be aware of, is this the right time? Is that the right tone? Are these the right words? And so I think, you don't do this, but a lot of people, when they get really, really interested in meditation and spirituality in their first year or two, there's a lot of navel gazing that takes place. And people might say things that I've heard it described as spiritual passive aggressiveness. They might say something that's actually comes across as kind of mean. And they'll be like, I'm just trying to be myself. So you don't do this. You're very gracious. But I do think pairing authenticity with an awareness of how that will land on someone else, that's a true superpower. So yeah. I'm not perfect at that. I think I actually probably hold back too much, but That's a balance there. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead. No, I appreciate you adding that for sure. But yeah, go ahead.
So Mela is my labor of love. If anyone's interested, you can go to thepath.com/Mela, M-E-L-A, apply, or just write me at sit@thepath.com. So Mela actually was inspired from my first Vipassana in India with no soap, no toilet paper, and no air conditioning. My thinking was, this retreat completely changed my life. It's what led me to start The Path, which has had a big impact on many, many, many people at this point. But what if I could create a retreat that had the ancient Buddhist teachings as part of it, but do it somewhere beautiful and then make it fun? We throw concerts at night. We have great, amazing musicians pretty much every night of Mela. What if we surrounded you with incredibly inspiring people like you, people who are authors and in tech and in creative fields and running nonprofits or in government, really interesting people leaning in terms of their impact on the world in a whole variety of fields. So that's Mela. It's a curated retreat that makes it, it's also kind of an easy onboard to meditation. So we have people who join who are super, super experienced meditators. And we also have people join who have never meditated before and are really nervous about being there and nervous about being part of the meditation. And it's just amazing. It's one of the great loves of my life. I do feel like I've created the perfect retreat that I then myself can't go on. But people come away and say, this is the best event I've ever been to in my life. And part of that is that when you meditate, you become raw. You actually become your real self. And Mela, we don't put any names on the name tags, no companies, no last names, just your first name. And I tell everyone, pretend that it's the first day of kindergarten and it's time to make friends. So people come as this, their innocent selves, like their real selves, kind of like travel me, not me being like, oh, please let me find an excuse to bring up my exciting startup job. But just as me, the girl that's traveling and hopefully fun and nice and just kind of cool and easy to hang out with. So people with that connect really, really deeply with the other retreaters. So the meditation is great. The concerts are fun. The meals are great. The places are amazing. We do them at beautiful resorts. The next one is on the beach. We might actually do a second one in 2023. So we can invite your community to that perhaps in the fall. But people literally meet their best friends, like the person they'll spend their birthday with, the family that they'll spend Thanksgiving with. And I think people connecting in such a deep way because you bring such a raw and honest version of yourself to Mela.
Yeah. And I agree. I've attended a similar event like that last year, but it's true. You're coming in raw, your armor's down, and it's so much easier to connect with other people and have that sense of community, which I think can be tough when we're in our daily lives where, you know, not everyone prioritizes meditation or being themselves or being able to disconnect from all things digital. But these events give you that opportunity where you meet like-minded people who are seeking a similar experience. So I think it's a great sense of community and being able to be in that environment where all of those things that you're seeking are encouraged, right? So I think it's amazing that you guys do that for sure.
Yeah. We always do the meals or six people around a table. We seat it so you don't have that school lunchroom, you know, from high school feeling. So you're always seated at a table. In fact, this year we've been putting everyone in a chair. Like you'll know exactly where you're sitting and who's sitting on either side of you. And we've thought about that really carefully. But then we do moderated questions. So one of the questions at a meal might be like, what about your personality is the greatest gift to the world? So you're really deeply connecting with the other people at the table, and really, really deep relationships, connections happen out of that, which as you're saying, is just really, it's really a beautiful thing to introduce people to their future best friends.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, I mean, Dina, this has been great. I've really enjoyed this conversation and hearing your story. I appreciate you being vulnerable and sharing so much with us. Is there anything else you feel like that would be relevant for the listeners that perhaps we haven't covered in as part of your journey that you've taken back and that you feel like other people can benefit from and perhaps might be struggling with as well?
Thank you, Hakan. And this has been an absolute delight. Yeah, I would say that we have these patterns in our personalities. We have ways that we do things. One of the things that I teach a lot in our teacher training and think a lot about just during the day is that we have these potential moments of freedom throughout the day. And that's essentially to take your expected behavior. Let's say you're at a coffee shop and the barista forgets your order, which for some reason happens a lot to me. It's like my Buddhist test every day at the coffee shop. So you might be tempted to get angry, to think, woe is me? Why is this happening? Why am I always ignored? But what if you could just take that as a freedom moment, let it be empty, as we'd say in Buddhism, and not assign a story to it? Maybe they just forgot. They're busy, they're stressed, whatever. They woke up late, whatever's going on in their lives, and actually just choose to be kind just because. Like that's a freedom moment. And I guess paired with that, I would say we're a lot more powerful than we realize. We have so much freedom and so much power to use language that we want to use, to be kind with our actions, even for no reason, even when someone isn't kind to us. So rather than thinking about yourself or all of us as a human race as having all these negative things happen to us, I like to encourage people to think of themselves as being really powerful and having a lot of freedom. And just with that freedom, making great choices to uplift people, to be kind, to be compassionate. And with that, we can live in a much lighter way, even just in our daily life.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's beautiful. And Dina, I know you've shared some ways that people can get a hold of you, but typically I give the guests an opportunity to share other ways of being contacted, whether it's online or social media. I don't know if you want to share any of that for the listeners, but I'll leave that up to you.
Oh, thank you. It's so kind. Thank you so much. Yes, my Instagram I'm super, super active on. So that's at Dina Kaplan, at DinaKaplan. So yeah, please follow me there. I'm super active about that. We'll put our teacher training programs up on there, usually, I think most of the time, or at the.path. The path, my company is at the.path. So we're really good about it there. And yeah, just email me if anything strikes you. sit@thepath.com. When I do incredible podcasts like this, we usually get a lot of emails, and it's really moving. And I want to I want to help people. I want to help you. I want to help people to feel more powerful, but also to feel more relaxed and to live with more delight and joy. So yeah, please feel free to reach out to me. Oh, and actually probably the best thing to do is to go to our site. It's thepath.com, like a path in the woods, thepath.com, and just sign up for our invitation list. We don't send a ton of emails at all. We usually don't even send 2 a month, but we will invite you to some cool things. And we'd love to stay in touch that way.
Yeah, that's perfect. I'll put all of that in the show notes so people will have that. But Dina, thank you again. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you've got a busy schedule, so appreciate it very much.
Thank you. You're the best interviewer and listener, I think, in world history. So I tip my hat to you, bow my head, whatever that expression is, Furkan. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Dina. As always, please leave a review or a comment in the comment section, letting us know what you thought about this episode. Or please subscribe to the podcast if you already haven't done so. That's the best way to support this podcast. Until next week.